Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. Hope you guys are doing fantastic today. Today we talk real estate development and we have with us Yoni Bach. Yoni, I know Yoni for a while and I know this conversation is going to be really interesting. Yoni, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Ishai.
My pleasure, my pleasure. You know what, before we even start digging in, if you could give everybody a 2-minute elevator pitch, what is Yoni Bach all about and what do you do?
Sure. So I'm a developer. I'm doing condo development in Upper Manhattan, mostly Harlem, and I'm starting now in Washington Heights. I've done 4 buildings, condo residential buildings on my own as president of Kane Ventures. I'm in the process now of renovating a 5-story church building on 142nd Street, turning that into 14 condo units. And I have one project coming up in Washington Heights on Hillside Avenue. So I take it basically from vacant land, or sometimes we have to demolish a building, and we build it up, usually 7-story buildings. This church building is my only renovation. The rest are all ground up construction. And, you know, I manage the construction. You know, we have an in-house general contractor. We do everything. We get the financing, we do the design, we do the construction. Then, you know, we use a sales agent to sell the units. We transition it over to ownership by the condominium board. And that's it. And then we pay off the bank loan. We give the return to our investors. And we move on to the next project.
Beautiful. You know what? Let me ask you this before we start digging in, because there's so much to talk about. So many questions that I want to ask you, and we're going to get to that. Why Manhattan? Why development? Why that area? How do you? But you know what? Before we even get to all those questions, how did you start and got into this whole business?
Okay. So I did civil engineering in college. I went to Columbia Engineering, and I got a job working in construction management, working for Bovis, which is now Lendlease. And one of the reasons that I wanted to work for Bovis is I wanted to move to Israel, and they were working on the Ben-Gurion airport project at the time. This was, I graduated in 99. I had worked for Bovis over the summer while I was in college, and then I worked for them full time after I graduated. And I worked in for first project was the Ramaz Middle School building on the Upper East Side, and when that was done, I moved into the estimating department. I was there for about a year before I was finally able to go to Israel with my wife. We lived there for 3 years working on the airport project, and then when we decided it was time to go home. I tried to get a job back with Bovis, but they at the time weren't hiring anyone. So I got a job working for a developer in, who's doing, condo buildings right at the start of the, Harlem condo market. This was, 2003. He was doing very well. He was very successful for a number of years, buying land that at the time was dirt cheap because there really was no luxury developments in Harlem back then. It was just starting. So he did really well, did a number of buildings in Harlem. And, you know, I learned since he was a small developer, I was, you know, even though I was coming from a construction background, I was able to learn about development, and how all that works, how you get your financing, and how you decide which projects to do. And so I was there until 2009. So, you know, 2009 came around and, you know, the market had just fallen through the floor. And, you know, he wasn't able to finish some of the projects that he was working on. No, banks weren't giving financing. So the company started to close and I got a job working for a developer doing affordable housing in the Bronx. I was there for about 2 years. And while I was there, I started to look around for properties to buy to go off on my own. I had a couple of investors, family, friends, some people wanted to go in with me. And we bought a piece of property in Manhattan, in Harlem, on 127th Street. We were able to get it for much less than the asking price because things were you know, really depressed at the time. This is 2010. And we bought it for very cheap. We got financing for it. You know, it was tough. It was a tough time to get financing, but I was able to pull in some favors from people that I knew from when I worked for another developer. And we were able to get financing, and we built a small boutique condo building, 13 units on 127th Street, 5 West 127th. And by the time it came to market, the market had really turned around. We were able to sell really quickly. We actually sold all the units while the building was still under construction.
Wow.
So as soon as we got our certificate of occupancy, we were able to schedule all the closings, get it done right away. And, you know, we closed quickly and we moved on. We bought another property two blocks away, 129th Street. It was a property owned by the Mormon Church that had some old building, one-story building on it that hadn't been touched in probably 50 years, and a vacant lot next to it. So we were able to buy that. Prices were still pretty low for land back then.
Amazing.
And we built a bigger building, 20 units, 19 residential, and community facility space on the ground floor. The residential units also sold right away. Things continued to go up. And on the ground floor, we ended up finding a tenant, which was the Jazz Museum in Harlem, which was moving from their place. They had a very small place on East 126th Street, which was coincidentally in the office where I, in the building where I had my office when I worked for that other developer. And we were able to make a deal with them to that we'd build out the space according to their specs and try to keep it soundproof and everything because they wanted to have performances there. And we were nervous about the tenants, you know, the residents who were buying residential buildings complaining about the noise. But we put in all kinds of soundproofing and we made deals with them about, you know, no music past like 9 o'clock and, you know, certain times they wouldn't be able to do it. And it ended up working out really well. We leased it to them. They signed a 10-year lease. And it actually brought a lot of prestige to the building. The people living there were really happy to have it there. And we were able to sell it with the lease in place to a developer. So we were able to get a really good return on the building. And, you know, the next project was 17 Convent Avenue on Convent and 128th Street. And while we were working on that one, we bought another building, another vacant lot, two blocks north of that, which was 464 West 130th Street, which was on the corner of Convent. So we called that 52 Convent. So 17 and 52 Convent kind of went up together. We marketed them together. The market started to slow down a bit. Then this is like, you know, 2019, 2020. Things slowed down. So we had a lot of units in contract during construction, but then some of the buyers were able to back out. You know, there was kind of a glut of building, especially downtown, you know, 57th Street, there were all that building. And that was mostly, you know, the luxury market. But the, you know, the excess inventory kind of trickled down and reduced property values even uptown. And then, of course, COVID hit and we weren't able to do any sales for that time. So, you know, we had most of the units sold, but not all. We leased out two of them, three of them, actually. because we weren't able to sell during COVID. One of them is still under lease. One of them we sold, and one of them is now vacant. So we still have two units left at 17 Convent. Those are the two penthouse units. And we have one at 52 Convent left. It's a duplex garden unit. So it's on the lower level. So those are the only ones we have left there. And so we have these other two projects now that we're working on. One of them is 142nd Street. It was a building that was bought from the Catholic Church. It had been used originally, it was a convent for nuns, and it had been used recently for just for offices for the large church next door to it. We're doing that, and we bought this property in a vacant lot in Washington Heights because we just had trouble finding any more vacant land in Harlem in good neighborhoods because it's just been so built up. So we kind of feel like we have to kind of move on, find other neighborhoods. So I think Washington Heights is the next neighborhood in the city to really start to break out. It doesn't have a lot of condos there now. It's mostly rentals. So I think we're breaking ground. I think there's a lot of potential there. We bought a property. It's high up on a hill. It's called Hillside Avenue. So it should have good views. And it's right next to the subway. We're excited about that project.
About the church. I really didn't want to interrupt you because we got a full scope of the evolution of how your business really evolved. And that's pretty amazing. And I think one of the most incredible things is because people, when they talk about, working in Manhattan is a very unique, know-how that you need there. Meaning it's a very unique type of a market. You need to know what you're doing over there. Just like in every market, but Manhattan specifically is a very, very unique type of a thing. And I think you also answered the fact, why are you mostly in Harlem, basically? Because your schooling, per se, was there. Meaning you worked for this developer and you started doing things there. You saw how he did it. And it was really underdeveloped at the time. And you came in and he did it. And you saw things as they were in the very beginning. And you evolved with it. And today it's really overbuilt, as you just described. But you had a big part of this, evolution of that area. That's incredible, I think. That's an amazing aspect.
Yeah, I think anything in Manhattan is, going to stay strong in the long run. It's not getting any bigger. People are always going to want to live in Manhattan. Even when things were shut down during COVID, things were a little depressed, but they didn't come down that much. People are always going to want to be able to take the subway. It's just super convenient, and to be able to enjoy, even if they're not working in the city, to be able to enjoy the shows and the clubs and the restaurants and all the life that's there in the city. So I think, Harlem still is going to be a good market for many years to come. And I think Washington Heights will as well, because, things are still reasonably priced there. And, you have the subway access. You have the prestige of being in Manhattan. So there's just, the investors also have a lot of confidence in Manhattan. A lot of our buyers are investors who rent out the units. And, just judging by the cap rates that you get in Manhattan, it's considered a very low risk proposition to buy and hold real estate in Manhattan.
We're going to get to the discussion about the market wise, in terms of Manhattan. We're going to return to that discussion, I guess. But at this point, what I want to ask you is, I want to go back to your story for a second and to ask you, there was a point of growth from becoming an employee to becoming a developer, to become, like you said, a construction guy, to think like a developer, and also getting the certain type of backing that you need as a developer. It's a very different world, as we know. And what I want to hear from you, if you could tell us a little about the transition, how all of a sudden you became a developer, what did you need? How much equity all of a sudden you need to pull out for this? The financing, you said you got the financing. It was not easy. You said it yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of how that happened? I'm sure that was like the birth of your business, but it was really something that you learned a lot from. But that required a lot from you to evolve and to become something else. If you could tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, when you start, you have to start small, obviously, and build up trust in your investors and your lenders. So starting off, the banks were only willing to lend 60% you know, loan to cost. And if costs go up, they're not going to increase their loan. So, you know, it started off at 60%, turned into, you know, 50% by the end of the project. So, but you need to accept that. You need to accept that returns are not going to be that great. But of course, the lower loans involve less risk. So your investors, you know, should appreciate that. And obviously, you can't take that much money for yourself in the beginning until you kind of established yourself. So you start off small, and you know, if that project works out, then you start doing bigger and bigger ones as you know, as you succeed and more investors find out about you, more people want to invest. You know, you need an initial amount of seed money, so you need someone to at least be willing to take a chance on you. So it helps to have, you know, family and friends who are willing to invest. It's good to have some contacts at banks or you know, with mortgage brokers who are going to, you know, be able to speak highly of you and be able to give confidence to their friends who trust them at the banks. So there's a certain amount of luck too involved with development, because you're essentially betting on the market and nobody knows for sure how the market's going to do. So if you have that combination of the luck and the, you know, and the skills to get it done and the people who trust you to put in some seed money, then it can work out. And then you, you know, you take that, both the money that you've made and some of the trust that you've accumulated and some of the additional equity that'll come, because as soon as someone hears that his friend made money on in an investment, you know, they want in on it. So the circle of investors starts to grow. So, you know, you take that and you try to put that into a bigger project, and then you grow from there. You know, and of course, there's setbacks because the market goes up and it goes down. So you need to be able to be honest with your investors when things are going down. Don't shock them at the end of the project and say, you know, the project didn't turn out like I thought. You got to let them know the whole time so they have at least that confidence that you're not pulling the wool over their eyes. And, you know, hopefully if you can show them that overall you do well, and when the market turns bad, at least your projects didn't do that badly. And when they do well, you know, that you, you know, that you're doing really well for them and making really good returns for them. And, you know, if they have that confidence, they'll keep investing with you in the future.
You know, something you saw, you went through, meaning maybe not yourself, but you saw firsthand how the recession, how, you know, everything happened in 2008 to the guy that you were with. And you came out of that. How did that affect you in terms of the fear factor, to see how he got hit so hard? And then you said to yourself, okay, I need to now come out of that, and I need to find financing, and I need to find equity, and I need to get this done after I saw the other guy really get hit hard. Obviously, you came in 2010. There was no better time. Everybody talks about it today. Obviously, we, you know, every event we go to says it's not 2010. It's not. We everybody says it for the past like 12 years. So it was great timing. But at the same time, the fear factor was there. Nobody said in 2010, "Hey, it's 2010." You know, it's that's the whole key.
No, it was terrifying. I mean, that's, you know, the nightmare scenario. But I learned a lot from that. One thing that I learned is not to be too highly leveraged. You know, developers, including the one I was working for, they often had these, you know, crazy financing structures where they would, you know, get your bank loan. The banks were lending like, you know, 80% at the time. And then they would take a mezzanine loan on top of it for another 15%.
Wow.
And they were only putting in like 5% of the equity themselves. And, you know, lenders were just kind of assuming that real estate would keep going up, and they were, you know, being quite irresponsible. Of course, when you do that, you know,
the
project goes down and you earn 10% less than the project cost, then of course your equity is completely wiped out. Anyone who invested with you is completely wiped out. And your lenders, you know, these mezzanine lenders are often, you know, they're sharks. They'll come after you. They'll take your stuff, you know, your personal, they'll come after you personally. And that's what happened. And it was, you know, it was very tragic to see, because there was someone who I was working for who was like on top of the world. And he had this, you know, this Ducati dealership, a liquor store. He had a condo in Florida, and pretty much everything was gone by the end of it. And it was very sad.
Oh, my gosh.
So you have to prepare for that bad scenario. You have to only borrow, you know, what you're absolutely certain, even in a downturn, you'll be able to pay back. You have to warn your investors that, you know, real estate is a risky business. If they're not, you know, professional investors, then you need to be honest with them and explain that to them, because they may not realize that that's a possibility. It also showed me that you have to know what you're getting into. In other words, if you're used to doing residential buildings, you know, you start getting involved in something else where, you know, one of the projects that I was working on was basically turning a commercial building into residential. And we did all the work before we got the permits. You know, that's a very risky thing to do.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. I want to speak about this.
Yeah. You shouldn't try to be a hero with the bank in terms of what the costs are going to be. You should always take out a loan that's bigger than what you actually need. Because, you know, at times like that, when, you know, credit markets tighten, they're not going to give you more money if things cost more. So you're better off taking out a bigger loan and getting more equity than you otherwise need. And, you know, of course, that eats to your profit a little, because you're paying, you know, you're paying points on the loan, even if you don't draw the full amount on it. If you take out a $20 million loan and you only draw 15, you know, you're paying fees on the 20, but it's still small compared to the overall project. And, you know, you'll have that extra $5 million in the event that costs go up. You know, because sometimes even if costs go up, even if the sale price is going to go up too, you're not necessarily going to be able to come up with that extra $5 million. So you really have to be cautious, and you really have to prepare for the worst case scenario. Because, you know, at times like that, when credit markets tighten, it's also, you're not going to be able to raise that additional equity, because people aren't investing in times like that. So, you know, it's a scary thing to have to go through, but, you know, you got to prepare for that.
Right. And good that you learned it that way. It's phenomenal. Yeah. I'll tell you a quick thing, meaning I shared this story a couple of times, but there was once I was invited to dinner, a Friday night, you know, Shabbat, you know, for a Shabbos dinner on a Friday night. And friends invited a bunch of people, and one of them was interesting enough. It was, I didn't know who that man is. Came in, was very old at the time. And I didn't know who it is, but you know, when they introduced everybody around the table, the person who came in was extremely old, and he had help that came with him. And he was a close friend of the family. And when they introduced themselves, I introduced myself also as a real estate guy. And all of a sudden the guy said, everybody said, "Hey, he's in real estate for years and years." It was Jerry Hines from Hines, meaning the Mega Hines, you know, corporation, obviously the founder of this company. And I sat right next to him. So I felt the privilege. I said, "If you could give me like one tip, you know, of how you did things and how you got it done to get it from that point to the other." He was really old at the time. He passed away, by the way, throughout COVID. I don't think from COVID, I don't know, but he passed away. He was already very old. And he said, it was very nice. He said, "The method that we have done things," and they're huge developers, he said that we took no more than 50 up to maybe 60%, you know, leverage.
Loan.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Debt. And everything else, I said, what was everything else? Because you're not talking about a $10 million, $15, $20, $30 million project. You're talking about, I don't have to tell you what we're talking about. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, of projects in prime location. And he said, "We take in all equity. We have a lot of LPs and a lot of great partners." So he said that was the main key of how we surpassed every single downturn. So that's the very similar to your experience in your own way.
It's a good long-term strategy. Yeah.
Why?
You know, in the short run, the people who are super highly leveraged, they look like geniuses, you know, and they, you know, double and triple their returns, you know, but then as soon as things go badly, you know, the geniuses turn into, you know, reckless fools for,
Right.
For risking everything.
You know what? I want to shift gears for a second. You're doing development in Manhattan. That is unique. A lot of people doing real estate nowadays for the past few years are talking about, especially during COVID, talking about the resilience of multifamily. And you are not there. You are in development. And you're in development in the most, I would say, in a place where COVID hit so hard. And there's so much entails in doing development, especially in that area. Can you tell us a little bit about your take on development versus the multifamily aspect that everybody talks about, the investment that is more, I would say, the safe haven or, you know, the income producing type of a thing? Tell us a little bit about the strategies and about your thought process about that.
When you say multifamily, you mean just purchasing rental buildings as an investment?
Exactly. That's what I mean. I mean, you went to development, condo development, especially condo development. I'm assuming it's all condo, right? It's all sales. You own some.
For the most part. Yeah, for the most part. I mean, as I said, you know, we rented out some units that we weren't able to sell during COVID. And we rented out the Jazz Museum until we were able to sell it. But the end goal is to sell. It's creating something, you know, instead of buying and selling, you're not adding value. You're just sort of investing. I came from a construction background, so I enjoy being able to actually build something, create something from nothing. There's money to be made during construction, as opposed to when you're just buying, you know, it's hard to justify a salary if all you're doing is just buying and selling. You're not actually creating anything. Your returns are obviously a lot higher. People are, in Manhattan, you buy and, get like 4 or 5% returns on a multifamily purchase. Developments, you're hoping to double the money, if things go well. Or at least try to get, 15% ROI. So it's riskier, but, it's potentially more rewarding and it's exciting and it gives you a good sense, that you're actually creating something, creating housing in Manhattan, which is still, New York City does need more housing. America needs more housing. So it's something good that you're doing, even though, developers often get a bad rap.
That's right. And tell me something, Yoni. When you come to develop, and you come to look for a good project, what is your formula of success when you come and look for a deal?
So, getting pitched properties all the time. There's all these investment sales brokers who are sending me properties. Of course it has to be in a good neighborhood. Not every neighborhood is ripe for condo development. There's a lot of neighborhoods where, people aren't going to buy. They're not going to buy right next to the, Metro North trains, which are so loud, and they're not going to want to buy next to housing projects, homeless shelters, things like that. So it's got to be a good neighborhood. Obviously the price has to be right. You want it to be of a certain size because, if a property is too narrow, even if you could build really high, you'll have such a big loss factor between the stairs and the elevator that, if you're paying a price per square foot, half of that square foot is getting lost to common space. It's not sellable. So you want to, you want it to be at least 50 feet wide. I always run it by the brokers who sell the condo units at the end and say, is this a place where you'd want to be selling units? Obviously the price has to be right. So you do a pro forma, you do a budget, how much is construction going to be? How much are they asking for the land? How much can I get for it at the end, sale price? Based on the financing that you think you can get at the time, what's going to be the overall return and how much are investors looking for in terms of a return? And if the numbers look good, you put in an offer and, you try to negotiate the best offer you can get. If you can come to a deal, great. Not, most deals don't actually work out for one reason or another, but you try enough deals, you get a few that work.
Tell me something. Working with municipalities is always a challenge. And Manhattan is known to be, you know, the city of New York is known to be fairly tough. What is your experience with, you know, with them, and how did you gain confidence in doing the right stuff there? Tell us a little bit about that.
So it's extremely difficult dealing with the city. It got even worse during COVID because you couldn't walk into offices. Everything had to be done remotely, which, you know, made it hard to really push. You know, expediters are experts in trying to, you know, really push people and get the various bureaucrats to do what you need to do. And it's a lot harder for them to do that when everything was remote. I mean, you have to take into account when you're doing the pro forma that there's going to be these delays caused by the city. From the time you buy the property, you design it, and you get everything approved and your permits, you know, take a year and a half. And that has to be built into your model for the project. What's good is if you go buy a property like the one I bought in Washington Heights, where there were already a set of DOB approved plans. The plans, it was designed more as a rental building, so we're going to revise those plans to make it more of a condo. But at least we're able to pull the permit based on the old plans and we get started. And, you know, the excavation is the same excavation. While we're doing the excavation, then we can work on revising plans. But at least this way we're able to get started and shave a lot of time off of the schedule. The church building on 142nd, I thought would go a lot faster because it's an alteration instead of a new building. The problem is that it was so difficult getting landmarks approval since it's in a landmark district, and then going back and forth between landmarks and the building department that it ended up taking a really, really long time to get started. So this is just something, it's one of the risks that you deal with, and, you know, a risk that you can try to mitigate in various ways, like trying to get a property that has approval. But it's a big cost and a big part of the schedule, not just at the beginning of the project, but at the end. You have to get your certificate of occupancy. There's tons of paperwork involved, inspections. There's also,
I wanted to ask you, I'm sorry, I'm stopping you. I just wanted to ask you, how instrumental with this whole process is a team? You have to use the right attorneys, the right expediters.
Yeah, 100%. All those things, you know, the right architect, the right, you know, your employees have to be good. And, you know, over time, you develop a better and better team. You start swapping out people who aren't performing, and you hire people that come highly recommended. And, you know, if you get a good team together, there's still risks. You know, you still have to deal with the city, but, you know, a good team can get things done faster. You want to use people who have worked together before, so they have a good open line of communication. The architect and the engineers and the expediters, you know, all these people should be talking to each other. It's good to have a lawyer that, you know, is very responsive to you and will get back to you, and one that you trust. There's just, you know, a lot of different people are involved in this, and you know, having a good team who communicates well with each other, who trusts each other, it goes a long way to getting things done.
Tell me something. Tell us a little bit about the financing environment today and your experience with that.
So it gets better and worse. Right now, you know, rates are still pretty low. It's just, you know, they raised things a quarter point a few months ago. It's expected to go up a little bit. Rates are fairly low, and banks are lending like 65% typically, loan to cost. They also have complicated formulas for determining, based on the value of the sales, how much they're going to lend. So you have to both have, you know, there's a loan to cost and then there's a loan to value. You know, typically the banks are going to want 1%. If you go through a mortgage broker, they want 1%. Sometimes you can negotiate lower fees. There's, you know, non-traditional lenders too, who will lend you much more, but they have higher interest rates and, you know, they have all kinds of clauses. You know, if things don't work out, they're going to come after you personally. So, you know, I go mostly with traditional lenders, safer that way. But, you know, if I do bigger projects, there's a limit to how much I'll be lent from traditional lenders. So I may need to go to some non-traditional lenders as well. Mezzanine loans are a lot less popular than they were before, you know, 2008. I know they still exist, but, you know, a lot of times banks, the primary lenders, don't want to lend to you if they know you're going to have a mezzanine lender, because they don't want to get involved in a whole litigation if the mezzanine lender doesn't get paid. So it's something that's done, but it's not typical. Sometimes there's seller financing for some projects. They've pitched that where the seller says, you know, they want to make some money on the deal.
Right, popular.
So they don't want to do it themselves. They don't have the expertise, so they'll sell it and do some kind of financing. There's also, you know, land leases. I was involved in one project with a former employer where there was a 99-year lease. The problem is that if you have a land lease, if the sponsor, the developer, doesn't own the property, you can't put a condominium on it because you can't subdivide the tax lots if you don't own the property. So in that case, you would have to do it as a co-op, and co-ops typically don't sell as well as condos. So I've looked into it on a number of projects. I've never done one on a land lease on my own.
Tell me something. You know, when you look at this whole scope of where Manhattan is in terms of development, you have the different areas, and you were in hell, and right now you're going to Washington Heights. Tell us a little bit about that market. Why are you going there?
So, you know, I'm trying to do basically what the developers did back in 2002, 2003, which is go to an emerging market where prices are still fairly reasonable and develop it and take advantage of all the upside potential that comes from a neighborhood where things haven't fully gentrified yet. I think that there's a lot of potential in Washington Heights. It has a lot of great retail there already. You know, it has the subway. It's part of Manhattan. It's part of the island. So there's, you know, real potential for having prestige there. It has a lot of nice rental buildings. It's just not that many condos. And I think, you know, you can still sell for a lot less than you'd have to sell in Harlem to make a good profit.
So the potential is there. So the potential is in Washington Heights. Very interesting. When you, meaning you're dealing with different sizes of projects, obviously. What is the largest project you had to deal with, and what is the difference between, you know, a larger project versus a smaller one?
So the largest project I worked on before I went off on my own, I worked on the Barequa Village project in the Bronx, which was 8 buildings, a mix of market rate and affordable housing, and a very large steel and glass building for Barequa College. So that was, you know, that was a huge project. It was 3 city blocks that were merged into one that had a huge team on it. You know, that's a lot different than the projects that I'm working on now, which are mostly 7-story single buildings. You know, there's no big team to rely on. You kind of doing things myself. I have a super in the field. I have a project manager in the office. It can be very stressful, you know, not having a big team tie behind it. Everything is kind of on you. It's hard to get the efficiencies that you get from a large building and the economies of scale. You know, even a small project, you still need to manage it. It's almost the same amount of work to manage a small building as it is to manage a large one. You also don't have the same kind of amenities available for the building that you would have on a large building. You know, a large building can afford to have a doorman in it because the cost is right. Split among so many units.
Right. Technologies so you don't have that doorman.
You have a small gym. You're not going to have, you know, a pool and all these other things that the big buildings have. So you can't sell for the same price that you would sell units in a very large building. So that makes it a little more challenging. So you have to buy property for less.
Tell me something. Do you use in your system, you're a construction guy also. So, you know, obviously, if you could tell us, you know, from your experience and what you actually do, the difference and what you do in practice versus taking a GC or using it as an open book system, like CM-wise, or are you doing it a turnkey type of a thing? What is your take on those?
So, you know, I do it all in-house because that was really my background. I was a project manager for many years in construction. So I don't have to spend whatever the GC fee would be is now part of the project. So it makes
20%
the project more profitable.
Usually, yeah.
Whatever it is, you know, and there's, you know, the fee that's in the contract. Then there's also the hidden fees that you get, you know,
right.
Depending on how you structure the contract. If it's a lump sum, you have no idea how much the GC is actually making. But whatever the GC would be making is now going into the project. You also have a certain amount of control. You know, you make sure that the subcontractors are not just the cheapest ones, but the ones that could actually do the job and do it well and get it done in a timely manner. And, you know, you have a good sense of what's going on. You know, if corners are being cut, you have a better sense of that. If suppliers are not being paid, you're going to know about that and not find out about it at the end of the project when you see these liens on the project. So it's a lot better to do it yourself. I saw that when I was working for a developer who had his own in-house GC. It's more efficient. Things will go faster. You don't have things getting lost in translation going through different parties. So, you know, you're still going through subcontractors, but, you know, you hire the superintendent directly. You control everything. You oversee everything directly. And, you know, you're able to control the project much better that way.
Tell me something. Do you have the desire of making larger projects or more of the same, but many more? Meaning, where are you on that?
Scalability. I would definitely like to do larger projects. As I mentioned, there's that efficiency. You have the economy of scale. You have the better amenities that you could do. So I think it is more profitable to do it that way. The problem is, you know, you finish one project, you know, you want to do a bigger project, you have to kind of finish with all your projects. And then you have, you know, bigger, you know, pot of money to do one big project. But then there's kind of a lag, you know, it's hard when you're doing everything yourself to have like a lag, you know, over a year or two where you're not pulling in money. So, you know, slowly I hope to grow and do bigger and bigger projects. You know, the kind of slowdown we've had in the market from the last 2 years, that kind of slowed my ability to grow the company because, you know, investors are more reluctant to invest in projects when, you know, the last project didn't get them the return that they were originally hoping for.
Right.
So as the market improves, I hope to grow it back up.
Let me tell you, rezoning wise, have you done rezoning with one of your projects?
No. You know, there have been some rezonings in Harlem, but mostly they're rezoning properties that are not so desirable, like, you know, along Park Avenue, which is along the Metro North trains. You know, they rezone that area. You know, if they happen to rezone a property after I already own it and upzone it, you know, that's basically like hitting the lottery. But, you know, a property that's already in the process of rezoning, no one's going to want to sell it because they're going to hold on to it themselves, hoping to make money on the rezoning. So I never had the fortune of owning a property and then all of a sudden it got rezoned up.
Right. It's a whole different process within a process. Very, very exciting. So when you look today at the market in Manhattan, it's something, and that's something I would like to close with. And I see that you believe in the market. I see that you know what you're doing. I see that you were there for many, many years. But at the same time, we saw what happened to Manhattan during COVID. And people fled out and people are actually moving to the Sun Belt. And now Manhattan is gaining a lot of people coming back, right? It's some people say it's 75%. Some people say it's 85 to 90% already in terms of the residential, you know, moving back aspect. It's not fully there what it was pre-COVID, but it's getting there. And it's going to get there without a doubt, but it's still in the process. But there's one thing that Manhattan has, and I want to hear your take on that. Manhattan has, meaning people who move to Manhattan usually move because the business world is still in Manhattan, meaning that's the Rome of our time. It's still there. It's still that. And the office market, which is not something that you do, is the primary, I would say, driver of Manhattan. So every single residential aspect you have in Manhattan is because of that aspect of office. Any comments about that?
Yeah, I don't know if the office is the only driver to Manhattan. Maybe it's, you know, for family men, for, you know, for people like us, maybe. But, you know, a lot of people really love New York for the culture, for the museums, for the arts, for the Broadway, the nightlife. You know, it's got the best restaurants, the best social life. That's a big driver. It has so many universities here. There's a lot here besides offices that will drive people to the city. And really, in the entire United States, there's no city that has quite as much.
Nothing like NYC.
In terms of entertainment and arts and everything. That's right. So it's always there. And the offices, a lot of them are coming back. You know, some people don't want to come back, but a lot of them are not being given a choice by their employers. So there's, you know, maybe to a certain extent, some people have gotten so used to working from home aren't going to want to come back. But there's always going to be a market for it. And there's some of the office space might get converted to other uses, but there still is a huge office market here. And there's a lot of other things besides the offices. You know, just people like being where there's a lot of other people. There's been a move to urbanization, you know, before there even were offices, you know, that's been going on for, you know, for 1,000 years. People have been shifting from rural to urban life. And that, you know, I think that'll continue, even if people are working. They'd probably rather be, if you're working from home, you know, would you rather be working in the suburbs so that there's nothing to do even when you're finished working?
Right.
Or would you rather be in the city where, you know, it's a lot easier to date, it's a lot easier to go and have fun and be with
other
people? So I think the market is coming back. I think that, you know, most people are going back to work. Not everyone. Most people are going back to work. Colleges are opening up. The nightlife is opening up. You know, there might be another wave. Who knows? But it'll eventually pass and things will come back. And, you know, I think Manhattan always comes back. Came back after 9/11. It came back after the financial crisis.
I agree with that.
It'll come back, and it's already coming back, and it'll continue coming back.
Yoni, before we say our goodbyes, if you could tell everybody how they can find you, and you guys can see the links above or below. But Yoni, if you could tell everyone how they can find you if they're investors and they're interested in your activity or partnerships of some sort, if you could share with us how they can find you.
Sure. Sure. You can go to caneventures.com. KaneVenturesCom. You can fill out the contact in there. You can. I just finally caved and joined LinkedIn after everyone telling me to do it for years. So
yeah,
set that up. I didn't set up my profile and everything yet, but you can find me there. You know, you can get my number, my email address, a quick Google search. I'm sure you can pull that up.
Your website, like you said, I think your website is the primary. A place, meaning LinkedIn, you're new, you'll get there. But in terms of the website, can people reach out to you there? Meaning, is there your email address?
There's a contact page there. You can also email me, ybach@caneventures.com. You can reach out to me there. You can get, I think, my the office phone number is on the website too.
Excellent. If you want to call. Yoni, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ishai. It's a really interesting conversation. And thanks for having me on.
No problem. My pleasure. And you guys, I hope you enjoyed it and you've learned a lot from it. And I'll see you in the next show. Hey, guys. Thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye Show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.